everybody, and welcome to the WG CompSci podcast. My name is Mark Young, and I am a 15-year veteran teacher of computer science and information technology courses, and this podcast is designed not only for my current students, but also for those among us who are students for life and love everything computer science and IT. This is our fifth podcast in this series, and we'd like to focus this podcast on C# programming fundamentals as they pertain to game development, and we will begin discussing information technology topics this week, including fixing common Windows errors, using msconfig in safe mode, creating a network Apple Time Machine backup location on a Windows shared network folder, and we'll discuss backing up both Apple and Windows computers to a network resource. Before we get started, we'd like to remind our listeners that you can listen to our podcast on iTunes, Google Play Music, Anchor FM, and SoundCloud. For those listeners who would also like to see video tutorials of computer science and IT topics, we encourage you to find our YouTube channel by searching for Mark Young Game Design. Note, we do have more playlists posted in addition to game design. Thank you to all of our subscribers and many viewers so far. Lastly, we welcome computer science questions or episode topic suggestions. So please email those suggestions to youngpodcastwghs@gmail.com. Okay, let's go ahead and get started this week. Over the next few podcasts, we will dedicate at least one segment to C# programming for game developers. The basics of the C# language are really transferable to any other C-based languages, such as Objective-C, C++, C#, and Java. So whether you become a game programmer or not, you can transfer this knowledge to a wide variety of other programming-related career paths. We will also help you become well-versed in the exciting and free visual game development engine, Unity 2017. Before we create a basic console application using Visual Studio, we're going to focus on the parts of the C# language first. We'll begin with variables. Just like in your algebra classes, whether recently or a very long time ago, variables are used to store data, whether it is assigned once and never changes, or is data that truly varies, as the name variable suggests, throughout the lifetime of a program. We will cover many more variable types in the upcoming podcasts, but we'll stick with the most commonly used variables for beginners in this first series. So let's take a look at some of the most common variables used in game development. We have the variable type called string. String contains data for a non-mathematical use. Numbers can be used with ints, but it cannot be calculated. Often, we use these to output labels such as game score, health, or the time so that the user understands what the number 25, 125, or 1:25 means when data from other variables is printed on the screen. They can also be used to output text for game instructions or dialogue between game characters. The second variable type is an int, which is short for integer, but we type int when we're declaring this type. Ints are 32-bit data types that hold only integers, whole numbers, positive and negative, within a very large range of negative 2 billion sum to a positive 2 billion sum. They can be used to record just about anything that has no decimal or values less than the number 1, such as coins, number of enemies, number of lives, total weapons available, or anything else your character has to have to keep track of. The third variable type is a float. A float is a 32-bit variable type that contains whole numbers, along with values less than 0, that fall in the range of negative 3.4 times 10 to the 38th to 3.4 times 10 to the 38th, so a very big range. It can be used for many of the same purposes as an int, but it can also be much more precise by allowing you to record the fractional values that are less than 1. Examples include health, where the measurements include a half unit of blood, or if you wanted to record how fast a character is running and his or her speed is between two numbers. Those would be some example of floats. For a lot of my students, this is their favorite type because it allows them to be very precise in their data. The fourth variable type we'll talk about is a boolean, or bool for short. A boolean variable uses binary logic, so it only has two possible options: true or false, on or off, yes or no. although when programming, the only data it can truly save is the answer true or false. Booleans can be used whenever you need to know if a setting is true or false or on or off. Is the door open or is the door closed? Do I have any lives left or am I out of lives? Am I running? Am I flying? Should something be repetitive, like shooting a weapon, continue shooting, and so on. So anytime you have a yes or no, true or false, one or zero, positive or negative type binary data, you would want to use a Boolean. Okay, so we have introduced some common variable types. But how do we assign data to them and how do we use them in a Hello World example program? Well, unlike an algebra class where the variable can be placed on either side of the equals symbol and the student still understands which component is the variable and which component is the data, C# and just about every programming language requires the variable to always be on the left side of the equal symbol and the data being assigned placed on the right side of the equal symbol. So let's take a look at some examples. We have int score equals 15. Int tells me the variable that follows will be an integer, only able to hold whole numbers. My variable name is score, and then after the equal symbol, I put 15, which means that the score variable will hold on to the number 15 until it is told that it will hold on to a different data. A second variable example would be string name equals Johnny in quotes. The variable is called name. So before the variable name, we put string so that we tell the compiler that the word name, that variable, is going to only hold on to string data. After the equal symbol, we put Johnny in quotes. Now, string variables are unique in the fact that the data must be enclosed in quotes to indicate to the compiler that this is the beginning and end of the data. It's all enclosed in between. And that gets a little bit more complicated, but strings are really treated as each letter. And so when you have something like Johnny as a string, it's actually concatenating or putting all of those letters together as one big string. We'll talk more about that at another time. The third example would be a float. So we have float blood level equals 15.5F. Okay, so my variable name is blood level, which may indicate how much blood a character has. Sounds a little bit morbid, but if you know our gamers, they get all into this. So blood level is two words. In the programming world, we cannot have spaces in the names of variables. So we have two options, really. We can name our variable all one word, all lowercase letters, or what I prefer to do is to uppercase the second and third and fourth word with an uppercase letter. Example, if we have blood level, I keep the B lowercase and I would uppercase the L and level because it is the second word in the series. So BLOOD, capital LEVEL. That's how I teach my programming students to do it, and it makes multi-word variables much easier to read when using them. Our fourth example is for a Boolean variable. So we would type bool, B-O-O-L, space, still shooting equals true. So this is going to be a variable that will hold on to only true or false answers. If you don't believe me, give it data besides true or false and you will get an error. So still shooting is going to be a two-word variable that I make into one word. So still is all lowercase. And then the S in shooting I uppercase to make it easier to read. So bool still shooting equals true. So that gives you four examples of how to declare variables and assign them data. Don't forget that at the end of each one of those variable declaration lines that you end with a semicolon. Some general rules to follow when naming variables. One, the type of variable gets typed first. So int, string, float, bool. Second rule, give your variable a name that best describes the data that it is holding in the fewest number of characters possible. In algebra class, we can say x equals 4 and y equals 7, and the variable names aren't that important because we're just trying to solve a basic problem. But in the programming world, you'll have a lot of different variables, and giving them indescript names will make it very difficult for the programmer to remember the purpose of the variable and the data that it holds. Okay, number 3, type an equals symbol to tell the computer that the data is coming next. So you can declare a variable without giving it starting data. But if you are going to declare the variable and assign data to it, you must put an equal symbol after the name of the variable, but before the data. And my fourth and final rule, type the data next. Notice that integers require you to just type the number. Strings require you to enclose the data in quotes. Floats require an F to follow the number. And booleans only hold true or false data. Okay, these are the recommendations that I give to my students when naming their variables. It is important to note that variables cannot begin with a number, they cannot begin with spaces, and they cannot begin with punctuation or symbols. Beyond that last statement, the sky really is the limit, but it is important to choose a variable name that helps you as the programmer best remember what the variable is holding data-wise. Also, it is completely acceptable to have a variable with multiple words, but I recommend the following conventions. 1. Lowercase the first word in a multi-word variable name, such as first name, lowercase the F, capitalize the N in name. Makes it easier to read the word. 2. Use descriptive names for variables to avoid confusion or ambiguity. Player score as opposed to just score or variable. 3. Shorten variable names as much as possible to cut down on the volume you need to type or read when reviewing or analyzing code. So we would choose player health over my main player's health number. It's a lot longer, a lot more to type. 4. You cannot begin a variable with a number, special character, or mathematical operator unless it is inside an if loop, and that's altogether something different. So cannot begin a variable with a number, special character, or mathematical operator. Let's talk about mathematical operators. The symbols used in C# programming are fairly universal in most programming languages and should be recognizable from your days of using a calculator in math class. Because of your lengthy background knowledge, I'm just going to show you the mathematical operators and then jump straight to the order of operations review. In order to add two numbers together, the addition symbol is the positive symbol. Subtraction, we use the minus key. For multiplication, we use the asterisk key on the keyboard, which can be found over the number pad in the upper right on most keyboards, or shift and the number 8. The division symbol is the forward slash, which we can find on most keyboards to the left of the shift key on the right side of the keyboard. If you want to find the remainder of a number, that's using the modulus or percent symbol, which is shift and the number 5 on your keyboard. And then in order to control the order of operation in an equation, we use parentheses, which can be found by using shift 9 and 0 on the keyboard. Let's talk about order of operations. When I was in school, our math teachers helped us to remember the mathematical order of operations by telling us to remember the random phrase, "Please excuse my dear Aunt Sally." And they left us wondering for days who Aunt Sally is and what she did wrong. As strange as the phrase is, it is one that I have never forgotten over the years. So what does this phrase help me to remember exactly? Well, the please represents parentheses. You use parentheses first. So the E in excuse is for exponents. My, it represents multiplication. Dear represents division. Aunt represents addition, and Sally represents subtraction. Finally, after all these years, we have found a fun way to use the old order of operations. In all of your future games, you will be relying heavily on mathematical equations to control everything from jumping, flying, running, shooting, catapulting, etc., and the order of operations will ensure that we are logically calculating our data properly and achieve the desired result we want from our game characters and assets. It is important to note that the misuse of these operators in an equation will usually not trigger a compile error, but rather it will produce the incorrect answer, and your game will use that incorrect answer in a way that you did not intend. Sometimes my students will end up liking the unintended consequences, but in general, I would try to achieve what you planned to avoid frustration. Okay, I think we've covered enough new information this week regarding C#. Let's actually try to make our first C# application using Visual Studio. We use Visual Studio Community in class because it is completely free to students and gives us all of the same functionality that we need for programming in C# that will communicate with Unity. Okay, so inside Visual Studio, click on the File menu and select New Project from the menu. From the Templates pane located on the left side of the window, select Visual C Sharp, followed by Console Application. Now, a console application is not going to produce a game necessarily. It's going to bring up basically a command prompt box that allows us to interact with the computer using the C Sharp language. In the future, we won't actually use console applications because we'll want to create classes from Unity. But for right now, just to learn the basics, create a console application. Step 3, at the bottom of the new project window, name your project Hello World. It is a tradition going back many generations, many computer science classes, that your first application has to be your Hello World application. Okay, step 4, select a different file location if you prefer. If keeping the default location, take note of where it is saving for future reference. One of the things I find with many of my students is they can create programs, they can save files, but they have a hard time going back and finding where they save their files. So please note down there where it says location, where you're saving. In the name of the file, really important, Hello World should not have a space in between the names, or the words, excuse me. Okay, at this point, you should see a window that has a class in it. It has a few lines that say using, and it has a main method. So because it has a main method, means that this class will be able to execute by itself. Okay, so Visual Studio can be a daunting program upon first glance, but I assure you that you will become more comfortable with its interface and features with experience as we progress in this podcast series. On the left-hand side of the code window, you will see line numbers. If these line numbers are missing, you don't see them right now, click on the Tools menu along the top of the window and select Options. From the bottom of the menu, you should see a box that says General, and then should be a checkbox that says Show Line Numbers, and that will really help to bring those up. So now we're in our C# class. We want to go between the two braces that follow the main method. The left-facing brace, which is the one that has the point on the left side, indicates that this is going to be where the main methods block of code begins with all of its statements inside. And then the closing brace is the one that slightly points to the right, which indicates the main method block of instructions is closed. So what I want you to do is press Enter after the opening brace and leave some space to type two lines of code to test our C# class. We're going to type on the first line, console.writeline hello world. Okay, so capital C in console, console, period, write line, capital W, capital L, parentheses, quotes, hello world, exclamation point, and then close quote, close parentheses, semicolon. So what that line is going to do is it's going to make the word Hello World show up in our console. On the next line, we're going to say console.readline. So capital C, O-N-S-O-L-E, period, capital R, capital L, open close parentheses, and then semicolon. Okay, it is really important that you enforce case sensitivity here, meaning that capital letters should remain capitalized and lowercase letters should remain lowercase when typed. There is no space before and after the period between console and write line. There is also no space between the E in write line and the first parenthesis. A very common beginner's mistake is to forget to type the semicolon at the end of the line of code. The semicolon tells the compiler, or the internal piece of software that converts our code into a language the computer's processor can understand, that the line of instruction is over. Not closing the line with a semicolon will create an error. Okay. In order to see what we can do with the code we just typed, we're going to have to compile our code. Compiling code is actually quite a complete process that, fortunately, the computer does for us upon request. In order to compile code when using Visual Studio by itself, as opposed to using it with Unity, we can simply press the Start button at the top of the application window near the center. It should look like a play button or a green triangle that's facing the right. We will talk more about the differences when compiling with Unity when we introduce C# with Unity in an upcoming podcast. Now, depending on how big a gamer you are versus how big a programmer you want to be, you are either really disappointed or really excited with what just happened. No worries. Both reactions are completely acceptable here. we have to start off small, like with this example. In order to get your feet wet and not make you wait until 5+ podcasts later in order to see how code is entered and compiled. For my gamers out there, we have to learn to program if we ever plan to make a game that we can call our own. This application is a console application, which means that it is a non-graphical application incapable of displaying anything other than text without a lot of work. We will be using console applications for many of our upcoming C# examples so that you can better understand how to program and not be distracted with all of the graphics of the game environment. I promise and assure you that it will be worth it all as we speed through learning to program and heading into more graphical topics with Unity. Okay, that concludes our C# programming portion of this week's podcast. Now we're going to transition over into our IT, our information technology portion of the podcast. So our first information technology topic this week is dealing with msconfig. Msconfig is Microsoft's system configuration utility that allows you to take a look at how the computer starts up, what programs and services are beginning when the computer loads and are currently running. One of the frequent problems I see with Windows 10 and Windows 7 errors is that there is an application that is directly causing that error and needs to be disabled to figure out what's wrong with it. Or maybe the application was installed unintentionally and needs to be removed. Or maybe an application we wanted is using far more resources than we were ever aware of. So what I want you to do on a Windows computer is to press the Windows key and followed by R, or right-click on the Start menu and choose Run, and type in msconfig. That's msconfig, which is short for Microsoft Configuration. Once you do that, press Enter, and Windows 10 or Windows 7 will launch a box that says System Configuration. And it's a really powerful utility that allows you to see how your computer is currently operating and determine if something needs to be removed. So on the first tab, you'll see a series of tabs, General Boot Services, Startup and Tools. But on the first tab, we have Startup Selection. How do you want the computer to regularly start up? So we see Normal Startup, which means it will load all device drivers and services. So if you suspect that a device driver for a newly installed device or maybe a recently updated driver may be the culprit to the reason your Windows environment is not running correctly, you may want to switch out of Normal Startup and choose Diagnostic, which says loads basic devices and services only. What that means is that it will only load drivers that are certified by Microsoft to be safe. They are produced by Microsoft. So it may not provide the full functionality of your hardware on your computer, but it will allow you to see whether or not Microsoft's safe device drivers will work. And if they do, that will probably lead you to the conclusion that the manufacturer driver is what's causing the problem. Again, it may, but Diagnostic Startup is one way to see if the OEM driver or the original to equipment manufacturer driver made by, say, HP or Logitech or some other company out there, if their driver is what's causing some kind of a problem on your computer. The third one we have is Selective Startup, and what this will do is it will allow you to say what you do and don't want to run in general. So you can say, I don't want system services to start up, or I don't want startup items to load, or I want to use the original boot configuration from when you first installed Windows. The one that I probably uncheck the most would be loading startup items, particularly if I suspect that it's a program that I have set to start when I first log into the computer, if that startup application is actually what's causing the problem. A recent client computer that I worked on took me a little while to figure out what application was causing the Windows menu to not work, and Explorer wouldn't even launch, Microsoft Excel would just show a splash screen and then sit still. And what I did is I went in and turned off some of the startup applications that I suspected could be the culprit from experience, and it turned out that it was either Dropbox, no offense to the Dropbox folks, it was either their application or it was a coupon printing application that was the likely the culprit. So when I turned off those items from starting up at first launch, the computer was as stable as could be. So disabling some of those startup items can help you to kind of narrow down which item is causing the problem. Okay, so let's take a look at the second tab. The second tab is titled Boot. If you click on that tab, you will likely, inside the large text area, see Windows and then the version of Windows you're running. You do have some advanced options there that you could click on. Those get a little bit more complex than certainly this podcast was designed for. But you will see the ability to go in and do some debugging, determine how much memory and how much processors are to be used at any given point. The ones I want to look at are under boot options. So you can actually change the way Windows 10 desktop boots. You see, we have a safe boot that we could check. So if we wanted our computer to launch in safe boot, which we previously would press, you know, maybe the F8 key on older versions of Windows, here you actually click safe boot and you can say, I want a minimal boot, which means I have no network resources, and low resolution, low graphics quality. I have an alternate shell letting me see the command prompt only. I have Active Directory to repair if I suspect that part of my problem is connecting to a Windows Active Directory server. Or I can say I want to have network resources so that I can still connect to the internet. So that's how in Windows 10 you change the way a computer boots up. Once you boot into one of those options, the way you would go back and change that is to go into msconfig and uncheck safe boot, and then the next time you restart, it'll do a regular boot. You see you have no GUI boot. Maybe that means you do not want Windows to load the graphical user environment, and that will only show the command prompt. So if you're having problems where your video drivers you think are the problem and you want to see, can I at least get to command prompt and replace a driver, or maybe transfer some data off of a computer where the Windows environment is completely corrupt or damaged or blue screen of death, then a no GUI boot would certainly be possible. You have boot log, which will create a log file of everything that happens as the computer started. We have base video, just very minimal video quality, not going to be able to use a graphics card in any great degree. And then OS boot information lets you know a little bit about the operating system itself and what it's doing at boot up. So that is the boot tab. The third tab we want to take a look at is the services tab. The services tab has a lot of information, and what it does is it shows you all of the applications right now that are either running or have run recently. And so that gives you a long list of all of the applications that are currently running in the background of your operating system. One of the things I like to do is check the Hide All Microsoft Services checkbox in the bottom left of this window, because generally Microsoft's services are not going to be what's causing the operating system to not work. It's going to be third-party applications that Microsoft has no control over, has not certified their application, but it's still running on your computer. So if you hide all of the Microsoft services, it will narrow down the list of applications that are currently running or have run since boot up that are being run by third-party applications. And so those are most likely going to be your culprits of an unstable operating system. Now, just because they're in the list does not at all mean that they're the culprit of an unstable operating system. It just means that one of them in the list is likely what's causing the problem. Okay, we go over to the startup tab, and this will let you know if you have any applications that are set to start as soon as the operating system's graphical user interface is visible. This is typically when you would see cloud services, or maybe the Dropbox app is listed, or Google Drive. Any application that is set to run in the background as soon as the computer is stable would show up in this list. So if you think that maybe your Plex media server, recent update to it is causing the computer to be unstable, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with Plex, I love Plex, but to say hypothetically that's the application that's causing some problems, you could go into startup and say, I don't want Plex to load at startup, and then reboot the computer to see, does it load stable? And if it does, you can deduce that Plex was likely the culprit. So sometimes, you know, a lot of this troubleshooting is really more trial and error. I know a lot of customers and users want there to be exact answers for how you determine what the problem is. And sometimes there is an obvious solution. Other times it's a matter of just trial and error. Okay, so our next topic is dealing with how do you create a time machine box somewhere on your network to back up all of your Apple devices. So Apple does sell its own device called a Time Machine, which essentially looks like a little Mac Mini that has a hard drive in it and a network port, and its sole purpose is to sit on your network and allow your Mac desktops to back up to those devices. So they're essentially NAS boxes designed exclusively for Apple devices. While I do love Apple's Time Machine capsule boxes, the problem with them is that they are expensive. And if you have an old computer laying around, you can very easily make your own Windows network share that the Apple desktop, the Mac OS, thinks is an Apple purchased Time Machine. And you can make it as big as you want, and it works exactly the same as if you went out and bought an Apple Time Machine capsule. So what we're going to do is we're going to walk you through how that is done. So what you want to do is go on to the computer, the Windows or Linux computer, although this is a Windows tutorial, but go on to your Windows computer and create a folder that you will use for Time Machine. So call the folder Time Machine, one word, capital T, capital M, and put it on that computer. Once you have created that Windows folder, right click on it and choose properties and then share it. The folder needs to be accessible on your home network in order for your Mac to be able to find it as a Time Machine device on the network. Okay, so we called it Time Machine, we shared it, and generally I would share it to everyone on the network. If you're the only one in the network or have one family username, then just choose that one user and give full write permissions to that folder. Okay, so what you want to do now is switch from your Windows device where the network folder is over onto your Mac computer, whether it's a MacBook or an iMac. So what you're going to do is open up the terminal on the Mac. You can open up the Mac terminal a couple of different ways. I personally just go down to Launchpad and search for Terminal. That's what I think is the fastest way. So open up Terminal, and you're going to type in CD space desktop with a capital D. The Apple terminal is case sensitive, so you do have to capitalize the D because on the Mac, desktop folder is capitalized. So CD space desktop, press enter. The CD command in a Unix file structure, so Linux and the Mac OS, which both use Unix, the CD stands for change desktop. So you're switching from your user folder on your Mac to the desktop folder for that user. What you're going to need to do next is create what's known as a sparse image. And a sparse image is essentially the file that will represent the hard drive structure of your Time Machine capsule. Okay, so this is what you're going to type, and I'm going to say it first and then I'm going to spell it out and say when to type the space bar. So we're going to type HDI util create size 600 gigs type sparse bundle fs hfs plus j time machine.sparse bundle. That whole line is what's going to get typed. So here we go. HDI util space the word create create space hyphen size one word, so hyphen size space 600g. Now it's up to you how large you want to make your time capsule. It's recommended that you have a time capsule that's as large as your Mac, but it really just depends on how much data you actually have on your Mac. If you have a 1 terabyte hard drive and you don't have it even remotely full, you don't necessarily have to have a 1 terabyte time capsule. So 600G means 600 gigs. You can change that to any number you want. If you want close to a terabyte, you might want to say 1,000 Gs, okay? So that G stands for gigabyte. So 600G space minus type, so minus key, T-Y-P-E, space. Now you might want to press the caps lock key or hold down shift because we're going to type the word sparse bundle as one word. So all uppercase, S-P-A-R-S-E, B-U-N-D-L-E, space. Uncheck the space or the caps lock key or let go of shift. and type minus FS. So minus key, no space, FS, space, in quotes, all uppercase, HFS plus J, end quote. So that's saying that the file structure is going to use journaling. So once you've got HFS plus J, all uppercase letters in quotes, press space after the second end quote. Time machine, capital T, I-M-E, capital M, A-C-H-I-N-E, period, sparse bundle, all lowercase, S-P-A-R-S-E-B-U-N-D-L-E. Once you've got that mouthful typed into the terminal, press enter. And what that's going to do is it is going to create the file on your desktop that will be needed in order to essentially trick the macOS into thinking that there's a time capsule somewhere on your network. Once you have created your sparse bundle file, your next task is to copy that file, go to your Windows network folder that you just created in the first step, and paste this new sparse bundle file. You can either choose copy and then go on your Mac's network and find that Windows share and paste it into there. You can put it into a thumb drive and move it however you need to. Just move the sparse bundle file off of your Mac's desktop and put it over onto that Windows computer shared folder called Time Machine. Now, once you have pasted it onto your Windows computer, you need to mount it from your Mac so that your Mac computer knows where the time capsule is located. So from your Mac computer, find the Windows shared folder, go into that Time Machine folder, and then double click on the sparse bundle file. Once you click on the sparse bundle file, what will happen is on your Mac's desktop, you will see a mounted drive called Time Machine. And that's because we called it Time Machine when we created the sparse bundle file, and it should appear on your desktop just like it's a drive. Okay, the third step then is to tell your Time Machine application in your macOS to use this new network time capsule. So what you're going to do is you are going to open up the terminal again or go into it, and we're going to tell it that we want it to look for alternative locations for the time machine. So to do this, we're going to type the following command. I'll say it first and then spell it all and space it out separately. Sudo tmutil set destination slash volumes slash time machine. Sudo is a Unix command for super user. So we're going to say sudo space tmutil space set destination, all one word, all lowercase, space, forward slash, capital V for volumes, so volumes, V-O-L-U-M-E-S with the V capitalized, forward slash, time machine, one word, capital T, capital M. Once you do that, you should be able to now go up near the date and time of your Mac and choose time machine. If you do not have Time Machine up there in essentially the Mac system tray, then just go down to your launch pad, find Time Machine, and Time Machine should automatically see that new network share. It will say that it's a Time Machine. You usually don't even have to select it. It should already be selected, and it should recognize it as the size that you created, 600 gigs in our example. When you're ready, test it out. Go ahead and press the button that says Backup Now and see how your Time Machine works. And then from there, you can set how often you want it to back it up, and it's good to go. You didn't have to buy a time capsule. You maybe used an old computer that was just laying around and gave it new life. So that's how to create a Mac time capsule using a Windows network share. Lastly, I want to talk about the importance of backing up either a Windows or a Mac computer. Backing up a computer is super important. We just talked about early in the IT session about how to go through and use msconfig to fix operating system problems. Sometimes updates cause problems. Sometimes installing new applications cause problems. Sometimes you just get a virus and your whole computer is compromised and things are just simply not working. So it is important to back up the data. Some of the most important data for a lot of families is going to be family pictures, family movies that are maybe on a Plex server. You don't want to just have one copy of that data sitting around your home. You really want to have a second one if you're not using some kind of cloud storage space. So you can do this right from your own home if you have an extra computer available. So what you're going to need to do, at least on a Mac, is to open up Time Machine and make sure that Time Machine is set to back up either to a real time capsule or to a network share that we talked about in our previous segment. Make sure you choose how frequently you want the Time Machine backup to be. You do have some options. So if you open up your Time Machine preferences on a Mac, you will see that you have some options by clicking the options button. You can say which folders you want to exclude. Say if you not really care about Apple settings, you just want your personal folders to be set up. But it says that Time Machine keeps local snapshots, as space permits, hourly backups for the past 24 hours, daily backups for the past month, weekly backups for all previous months. The oldest backups are deleted when your disk becomes full. You have an option over the left to choose backup automatically, which will ensure that it's happening without you consciously doing it. It'll happen whenever you set up that time to happen. So you can choose select disk, make sure it's choosing the correct one, and Apple will automatically choose that backup for you. So Apple makes backing up a computer pretty easy. It's not all that difficult to do on a Windows computer, but you do have to go in and change some settings for it. So let's talk about those. So on a Windows computer, the easiest way for me to get to backup settings is just to go down to the search field near the start menu and search for backup settings. Backup settings exist within the settings apps on Windows 10, and you will see that it will ask you whether or not you want to automatically backup your files, which for me is a no-brainer, but some folks may want to choose when to do it so that it's not taking up a lot of network bandwidth or traffic at any given time. But click on More Options to set up specifically how your backup on Windows 10 will work. Microsoft's backup utility in Windows 10 is far better than it was in older versions of Windows. But when you get into the More Options settings, you can choose if you want to back it up right then. If you know you've got some critical data that you don't want to wait until 3 a.m. for the automatic backup to happen, you can choose then. You can choose how frequently you want the backup to be. You can say whether how long you wanted to keep your old backups, whether you want to keep them for an eternity, or if you want to just erase them after a certain number of days. You can, using the addition symbol that they give you, choose specifically which folders you want to use and which ones you want to exclude. So the Windows backup utility is really pretty great. This goes for both Windows and Apple computers, but you don't want to choose to backup your computer on the existing computer. Right. If I say that I want to back up my Windows computer on the existing computer and that computer fails, well, my backup probably is going to be inaccessible. So you want to choose to back up to a network resource or an online resource. I personally prefer network resources in my home or my business, so therefore I can easily access them and not have to worry about the internet being stable and strong and bandwidth strength and all that kind of stuff. Just having an old computer in a house doesn't even have to be anything too powerful. Just a place that you can dump all of your backup data on. If you have a computer that's maybe too old to use a modern version of Windows, try throwing Ubuntu Linux on it and setting up what's known as Samba Shares, which I'll talk about in a future podcast. But what Samba Shares are just the Linux community's way of reproducing Microsoft network shares so that Windows and Mac computers can see them, and you can have a great backup computer in your house and not have to worry about any of your data being lost. Okay, so let's recap. We talked about how to create C# variables and what are the types and how do you assign data, what are some rules for using variables and how to name them. We talked about mathematical operators and a order of operations, and then on the IT side, we talked about msconfig to you shut down services and look at applications that are currently running for troubleshooting purposes. How do we create a time machine on an old Windows computer on our network so we can back up Macs and save ourselves a little bit of money? And then how do we back up computers on a Mac OS or a Windows 10 computer? All right, everybody, that does it for this week. Take care. Have a great week ahead.